You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
Staging a protest in a country where women's rights are highly restricted is a brave act of defiance. But then writing about it publicly, where the safety of the author and everyone around her is placed in jeopardy, is another. Author Manal Al-Sharif, daughter, sibling, mother, computer science engineer, citizen of Saudi Arabia, and one of the very few female workers at the world's largest oil company, put out a call in 2011 for women in her country to drive publicly. Why this act was so daring and defiant and potentially dangerous to those who heeded her call was because Saudi societal norm prohibited women from driving. Women in Manal's home country spend up to one-third of their salary to pay male drivers for transportation because they are barred from transporting themselves. What unfolded after this act is the fascinating and harrowing story the author of Daring to Drive, A Saudi Woman's Awakening, is here to talk about tonight. Al-Sharif has been recognized by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world, and by Arabian Business as the most inspiring Arab woman. She was also awarded the Vaclav Havel Prize for Creative Dissent at the Oslo Freedom Forum. In reading her story, one learns of Saudi Arabia's complex history and the mores and politics that have shaped the place from which she was forced to live in exile abroad. Manal Al-Sharif's struggle illuminates the many universal lessons from which one can learn, from speaking up against the status quo to the potential that lies in reaching out to those who are the silent majority. What's most evident is that she is a fierce defender in the belief that only true freedom will come when women are considered and recognized as full citizens, and they themselves also start taking action to drive their own lives. In conversation with Manal tonight is a loud friend and host of NPR's All Things Considered, Kelly McEvers. McEvers has served as Middle East correspondent for NPR, where she earned multiple awards for her coverage of the Syrian conflict. She has also covered the Arab Spring, the war in Iraq, and the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. We're always delighted to have Kelly with us, and with that, please join me in welcoming her and our guest and author, Manal Al-Sharif, to Aloud at the LA Public Library.
Hi. Thank you. Thanks. Full house. Wow. Thank you, Los Angeles. Thank you.
Manal Al-Sharif, I want to say just welcome. It's so great to meet you.
Thank you.
As someone who also lived in Saudi Arabia for a brief time.
I had no clue.
There were still a lot of surprises in this book, and I'm really excited to share them with the audience. And congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
You know, I was thinking about how to structure this interview, and I was thinking that the structure of the book itself is so wonderful, and I was thinking maybe we could start that way. Start where the book starts.
The rest at 2 a.m.?
It's a pretty intense scene. Yes. You're basically on your way to jail. Tell us about that.
So the book writing took 6 years, and I wrote it in
chronological.
Chronological. Yeah. I'm very bad with long words. And my editor thought to start the book with my arrest as a climax. So usually the climax come later in the movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they decided to move it to the first chapter, and it did create a hook. I always hear that people, we couldn't put it down. Was the question about
tell
the
us
process?
What happened, I mean, that night.
Yes. So it was 2 a.m. In May 2011. It was after me posting that the video of me driving on YouTube. The secret police came to my house. it wasn't the police, it was the secret police, because they lived in a compound where the police cannot enter. The religious police or the police cannot enter.
I think it's important for people in the U.S. to understand, that to really put a point on that.
The secret police. It's your CIA.
And there's the secret police.
It's our CIA. We call them the babies. Uh-huh. It's pins, because we don't know. It could be a neighbor, it could be your brother.
And these are people in plain clothes. They're not in uniform. Civilian clothes. They don't have badges. They don't have name tags.
They work with you. They live with you. So we have them, I would say, waved in the texture of the society. That's a problem.
So they came to your door at 2 a.m.
At 2 a.m. And I had no clue where they were taking me. And that's when I called the reporter who did interview with me in the CNN, from the CNN. And I said, there are people outside my house. I have no clue who they are. I have no clue where they're taking me. But I wanted to write about it. Thankfully, she did.
Right.
And she posted it in the CNN. And I, when after the interrogation, they took me to the police. And in the interrogation, I was sent to jail with no charges. The paper said driving while female. It was the only charge. Yes, it is a charge in Saudi Arabia, driving while female. I think in the US, you have a similar one, driving while black.
Driving while black.
Yes. So you can relate to. And that moment, I knew if I enter jail without a trial, without a warrant, without anyone knows that I'm in the woman prison, I'll be there for long, if not for eternity. So that moment, I managed to get a phone call, and I called my sister-in-law, and I said, talk to the Twitter guy. He's our friend who is responsible for our woman to drive with Twitter. And I said, tell him to tweet about it. And she said, what's tweet? This is why it's important to follow the millennia. This is why I'm on Snapchat.
I love this moment in the book. She says, what's tweet? And you say, just tell him tweet, and he'll understand what I'm talking about.
So that tweet, so this is the importance also of social media, why it's very important in patriarchal and high authoritarian societies to use social media, because you don't exist if you're not on social media. You could just disappear and no one knows about you.
So he tweeted.
And he tweeted.
And people were eventually able to know.
Yes, they started a hashtag, Free Manal, when they knew that I was in jail. But when I was in jail, I was isolated. So the newspaper came with a different story, five charges. One of them was inciting the public opinion, encouraging women to drive, and contacting foreign media. That was the CNN. Right. Yeah, I had five charges. And the mosques did that Friday, the mosque sermons, and the imam took the sermons to condemn my act, and called it act of evil, and called it opening the doors to hellfire, and corrupting the Muslim woman, for simply calling for the drive to drive.
And it's funny, you had looked at the statute that dictates driving laws in Saudi Arabia, and you had seen nowhere in this statute
specify the gender.
Does it say anything about whether women can drive or not? And so you, when you were with your interrogators and your accusers, you said, wait a second, this isn't actually against the law.
Exactly. So it's interesting in Saudi Arabia, because it was a custom that women don't drive. Women were not seen driving, and that custom became something that this should be the normal thing.
Right.
It became the norm that women cannot drive. Although today, if you go to the countryside of Saudi Arabia, women drive.
They do.
Women have guns, by the way. It's not only...
Yeah, they don't just drive. They drive trucks,
and they have guns, which is amazing.
Yeah.
But in the city, women are not allowed to drive because they were not used to seeing women behind the driving wheel. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea of the movement was to make the society, to normalize the society, to see women behind the wheel. It's not some ET coming from outer space.
Right.
She's just a human being like me. She's just the only thing. She moved from the right seat to the left seat.
Yeah. Exactly, nothing exploded.
Oh my God,
we're all fine.
But
I mean, this is the thing, right? And I think it's important to explain to people is sort of what's the underpinning of the societal, restriction on driving. Where does it come from? Because it's actually not that old of a tradition. It's actually something quite modern, as you said. Bedouin women in the desert drive.
Yes. Do you
it's
know
something
that
that's came with the rise of cities and the modernization of Saudi Arabia?
Do you know that in the U.S., when the car was invented, men were the ones who drive it, not the women? And there was this one brave woman. She took a car. She wanted to encourage more women to drive. And she drove all around the state to encourage women. Did you hear about this story? So because I'm into this movement, I learned a lot about how women in the U.S. started driving. Mm. And how, for example, Susan B. Anthony used the bike to emancipate women. And she said, I've never seen anything emancipate women more than riding a bike. Makes her independent. And they wrote, there is a book called Wheels of Change, how the women rode the bikes to freedom. Remove a bike, put a car. Same concept.
Mm-hmm. But what is it that the religious establishment believes will happen if women drive? What is their sort of reasoning? Yes.
Do you have the gist of the evening? There is actually a fatwa says if women drive, her ovaries will be ovaries.
Her ovaries.
Ovaries, yes. I'm sorry. Even the word, the first time I heard it from the sheikh, will be damaged. So we create a sign with the woman ovaries and saying, don't drive, putting two hands, just mocking them. We have actually a study, an official study, claiming that the UNESCO did a study that societies with women drive are more prone to having more adultery, more illegal children, more divorce rate than societies with women don't drive. Given that the societies that don't drive and drive is Saudi Arabia and the rest of the world. So that was actual study that was presented to the consultative council from a professor, university professor. Our study was thrown, and his study was there.
Sorry.
Bless you.
But, you know, I heard so often, too, the idea was that if women go out and drive, they'll be encouraging men, you know, to
harass
them, to pursue them. It's for their own protection that we don't want them to drive because, you know, men and women aren't used to mixing with each other. And so if you
but
see
it's okay
them,
to have a driver, male driver in my car.
You could mix with them in your car as long as he was your taxi driver and you sat in the back seat and he was from another country. But it was this notion that, like, if you pulled up at a stoplight and saw a woman behind the, you know, driver's seat, you would, like, go crazy somehow and, like, start chasing her or following her. I mean, that was the reasoning.
We've been through so many reasons why women shouldn't drive. Uh-huh. One of them, like, what if the tire go flat? I'll just call the road service.
Right.
So we had all type of things.
What if a tire went flat?
Saying, like, you will be raped, you will be, there are men wolves. So what we did, we created a page. We've listed all the reasons why women shouldn't drive, and we answered them. And every time someone says, you shouldn't drive because you're a queen, and queens don't drive, we post a photo of Queen of England driving her Jaguar and say, real queens drive cars. So we're ready.
Every time they come up with it.
We answer.
Yeah. And obviously, this, you know, women have tried before to protest.
Yes.
In 1990, very famously, a group of women decided to drive in Saudi Arabia. It was after after the Gulf War. U.S. troops were stationed in Saudi Arabia. There were women among them. They were driving. True. I think women in Saudi were encouraged.
And women from Kuwait were driving.
Yeah. Women in Saudi were encouraged to go out and drive as a protest movement. They did not fare well after that protest, did they? What happened?
So 47 women took only 12 cars. They drove around the main street, I can't remember, Da'iri? I don't know what's that in English. The one that goes around Riyadh. Yes, in Riyadh, in the capital of Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. They were arrested by the religious police, not by the society, not by the traffic police, by the religious police.
Right.
They were arrested.
We got the secret police, we got the regular police, and we got the religious police, just to be clear. Okay.
Things are changing. The religious police cannot arrest anymore. They were stripped from that power recently. They were arrested. I was arrested by the religious police. This is an interesting thing. Their cars were confiscated. They summoned their guardian. And I'll explain to you what guardian means for a Saudi woman. And they fired them from their jobs. And they banned them from leaving the country for the simple act of driving.
Mm-hmm. And they really slandered their names. I mean, that's one
big
tactic
time
that you see often in Saudi Arabia. I mean, they did it to you as well. They've done it to other drivers. They print stories about past troubles with law enforcement and the government.
Yes.
This is why
we have social media today. They cannot do this anymore.
Mm.
Yes,
so there is
a video came this week because of the Qatar. If anyone heard about the political unrest between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, they ended the political connections between both. And it was funny. They post this video of Sheikha Moza. She's the mother of the Sheikh of Qatar, that she sent $2 million to me, to my account, and everyone is questioning my now credibility because of that $2 million. I'm like, if I have $2 million, I'll fly all my friends first class to Hawaii. We'll spend the summer there. Exactly. And I'll come back and campaign.
Right. So,
but it's always been questioned. So these ladies, they were questioned their credibility. But at that time, they didn't have a podium to voice their views.
Right.
They couldn't talk. They couldn't defend themselves. I was one of the people who thought they were bad women. So because I grew up hearing all these terrible things, that they took off their hijab, they were dancing with the American troops, and they, exactly, they just drove. But how the story is distorted when it reached, because there's no one there to say, this is what really happened.
Right, and now there is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Because people warned you, right, when you started your driving campaign. The whole, the beginning of all this was you started a campaign on June 17th.
Yes.
We're going to go out and drive. And people pulled you into their office and said, hey, look at what happened to these women in 1990. But you weren't, that didn't, didn't bother you, did it?
No. No, I was hopeful because it was the Arab Spring and it was the year of change around us.
It was 2011.
And all the youth are speaking up and using social media for to push for social change. And we waited 21 years.
Yeah.
It was 2011.
Yeah.
It's been a taboo for 21 years.
One of the great things about the book, too, is that it's also your story. It's the story of you. I think there's a lot of, people have a lot of preconceived notions about Saudi Arabia, that everybody's really rich. You know, they imagine you as an activist. You must have had, like, professors for parents or activists for parents. So I just want to talk about your own story. I mean, you grew up in Mecca, the holy city of Mecca. But you, your family was not well off. And you actually were very religious when you were young.
Yes, I was radical. So Mecca is one of the poorest cities in Saudi Arabia.
Which is shocking.
Which is shocking because it's the richest city when it comes to religious tourism. We have 66 slums in Mecca. So that tells you something. We were living on the skirt of one of these slums. So we were better off our neighbors, for example. We had better house even than them. But most of people in Mecca, the previous generation, would work minimal jobs. Like taxi drivers, working in a fuel station, or they would accept these jobs because they're not educated. So they cannot take public office or government jobs. Whoever had a government job, he was doing very well. But that was the I would say the atmosphere in Mecca growing up there.
Mm-hmm.
I was born 79, and 79 is the year when the siege of Mecca happened.
That's right.
And the siege is one overlooked story in the history of Saudi Arabia and the world. And that story really changed the course of history. And no one really realized, no one remembers, no one knows. Anyone heard about the siege of Mecca? You heard. How did you hear about it?
It was in the news.
You heard it in the news here in the U.S.?
Because it was right after the hostages
in Pakistan,
in Iran. It was after the hostage takeover, I think, of the American embassy.
So one American heard about it.
Yeah.
The rest didn't.
I mean, I knew about it because I lived in Saudi Arabia and I read the books, but like that only because I had to.
But it's interesting. Do you know Saudis do know about it? Did you know
I know about it from you.
From me, when I gave the speech in Oslo.
From the book.
I brought up the story in 2012 when I gave my speech.
Yeah.
And I said, I was born in the year of trouble. And I mentioned Jihaiman, which is the leader of the militia who... they held 120,000 pilgrimage as hostages in the Holy Mosque. The Holy Mosque of Mecca is the Grand Mosque, which is the holiest and the most sacred place for Muslims, where you cannot shoot a gun, you cannot fight, you cannot even cut a tree. This is how holy that place. And then you have this man with his group who hold the siege, they lock all the gates, and they keep people hostages, and they call for the true Islam because he thinks that the monarch is not representing the true Islam.
That's right.
And the monarch...
So he himself was a radical Islamist.
Extreme radical Islamist. And this Jihaiman, he had this ideology of the radical Islam or the literal translation of the Islamic text that he wanted to enforce in the Saudi society. So the king, he was traumatized. It was the fourth king, King Khalid. And that time, the country was going through modernization because of the oil... because of the education of women was happening. It started in the 60s, like very few years before.
Right.
They were not happy with that. They were not happy with seeing women working and music on TV. So the king, when he went to the ulama, and he said, I need your permission to attack the Holy Mosque. This never happened.
Right.
For Muslims, this is like outrageous to attack a sacred place. But he had to end the siege. And they said, we will accept with one condition. The same things he was asking for. They said, don't provoke. So you have to follow these rules. So they ended the siege. They killed, they beheaded Juhayman and all his group in a public execution, but they adopted the ideology.
Yeah.
And that what made the country go back. The same time, they were the embassy in the U.S. embassy in Pakistan was attacked because people thought the Americans were the one behind the siege of Mecca. Mm-hmm. And this is very important to understand. Also, I think in Tunisia too happened the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's important to understand the aftermath of the siege of Mecca.
Absolutely,
it's huge on the history today.
Yep.
79 is also the year of the revolution of Iran. So you have the Sunni Islam and the Shia Islam uprise, and they're competing. We have 1.5 billion, 55 Muslim countries. Everyone is fighting for power. Everyone fighting to have its final say. Mm-hmm. As the birthplace of Islam, Saudi Arabia, we are the protectors of the faith. The king is called the custodian of the two holy mosques. So this uprise really hurt the Islam, I would say, because it imposed this ultra-Orthodox, ultra-conservative Orthodox version of Islam.
And that's when you started seeing these fatwas against driving, yes, against
Mickey
Mouse,
mosque,
against TV, oh, yes, you know, satellite dishes. You know, I mean, again, people think these are things that are have been around for, yes, a long, long time, yes, but they're not. It was actually very, very modern.
It's important to know that every new technology, every new invention comes to Saudi Arabia is always fought badly. The satellite dish, as you mentioned,
right?
Barbie. I had to smuggle my Barbie from Egypt. And music. Oh my God, the camera phone. I smuggled my camera phone. We always smuggle. Saudis,
you can very learn from good us. At this. Very, very
we smuggled books. We smuggled camera phones. So my first camera phone was from Bahrain, and I smuggled it through the causeway under my, it wasn't the,
nice,
the mat, mm-hmm, my feet mat. And they can, you cannot stop modern civilization from happening. Right.
Bluetooth,
banning,
that was
things,
another one. I remember,
oh my
when
God,
Bluetooth,
yes,
was
Bluetooth,
a big problem.
Internet,
yeah,
everything, yeah, was. We had to go through fights with the religious establishment over every single new invention. It wasn't easy. But what happened to Europe and the church? The church was putting so much rules on people and controlling them, and the people said, you know what, I'm not going to listen to you anymore. I'm going to do A, B, and C. And the church now had to change because the people, it lost its power over people. Mm-hmm. They were asking too much. Saudi Arabia is happening the same. The religious establishment asking us too much. They were fighting the social media. Now the religious people, the ultra-conservative religious people, they're all over social media. So, wow, you fought us, you banned us, and we ignored, and we went, and we're alive there. You followed us.
But you were growing up, though, in this time where the country was turning backwards,
yes,
in terms of sort of the religious ideology.
Yes.
And you were just a kid, and you went to Saudi schools. And so you were very much in line with these thoughts when you were young, yeah?
Yes. Actually, in my teenage years, mm-hmm, not before. Before, yeah. I would draw, I would just be a child.
But you talk about, you know, thinking that other women who didn't cover property,
yes,
properly were, yes, infidels. Yes. You know, I mean, just having very...
I was called infidel when I uncovered my face, mm-hmm, once by a fourth grade in the airplane. She said, are you infidel? Because I uncovered when the food came. So yes, it's
but you remember thinking that way when you were younger.
I was like that. I was, mm-hmm, like, oh my God, I was like this.
And it was really going to university, right? King Abdulaziz University in
Jeddah, yes,
which is a very different city from Mecca.
Liberal. It's the most liberal city in Saudi Arabia.
And I think that's probably a surprise to people too, that a woman from not the, you know, most wealthy background, that you, I mean, you got a scholarship to go. I mean, if you get accepted, it's paid for.
No, no. Education in Saudi Arabia is free.
Yeah.
And our college, our university is the fifth top university in the Arab world, 22, mm-hmm, countries.
It's a great,
so the good thing about Saudi Arabia, education for men and women is free, all, yeah, the way to your higher education. Your graduate study.
Right.
By the way, we have 120,000 students studying abroad. Most of them are here.
Yes,
scholarships. The country pays for these scholarships,
yep,
fully, plus a salary.
King
I was paid
program.
Salary what to go to the college.
Right.
Yes. So that's
so that I mean that's
thing
a
about,
thing that would probably, yeah, surprise people. I think,
yeah,
that you as again as we a woman had that opportunity, and when you went to university, that's when you really started to.
Yes.
Like you, like one
different.
Does at university, right? You started to read.
Just imagine someone from Utah moving to New York.
Exactly.
That was me.
Yeah. you know, you were able to do sports and cut your hair and read and, you know, meet people from different backgrounds. And eventually you got a job at Aramco, which is the state oil company.
Which is started from California, by the way. It started from
Absolutely. Yes. So it used to be called the Saudi American Companies. That's what Aramco
means. It was a California Standard Oil.
Right, originally. So you went there. You had a computer science degree. You went to Aramco. And I think now is an important time to talk about
this
guardianship.
And apartheid.
And, Yeah, and how, you know, you go to university, you get a great degree, you do really well, you get a great job, and that should be like the beginning. You get your own apartment and everything works out. But for you, it was not like that. And it's because you're a woman. Can you sort of explain how?
Let's step back. So in Saudi Arabia, there were 250 girls applied, enrolled in computer science. Only 60 girls graduated. Only two girls got jobs. I was one of these two girls. We're only, at that time, we're like less than 10% in the workforce as women. So highly educated women, but they don't find jobs. They stay home. When I got my job in Aramco, it was the only company in the whole kingdom in 2002 that allows women and men to work together. So we have strict apartheid between the genders in my country, where men and women don't mix. My own cousins, when I turned 12, when I got my period, I could not see them until this day. If I walk in the street, I would not recognize my own cousins.
Your male cousins.
Yes, my male cousins. Because the apartheid is enforced not only in the public space, but only in our, but also in our homes.
So because their potential, you know, you could potentially marry them. So
anyone that you have
potential, that you could have a potential romantic relationship with.
Exactly. You lived inside. So when you go to a restaurant, you cannot enter them. There are two separate entrances. Even the government offices. By the way, the first public library I entered in my life, it was Nashua Public Library in 2009 at the age of 30. Because in my city, Mecca, we have one public library. You have 73 here. Wow. So we have one public library. Women until today are not allowed to enter that library. And if there are public libraries, there are special days for women to go to the public library. So this is how the apartheid goes that far. So to work in Aramco, that was revolutionary. It's an American company that kept, even after it was bought and acquired by the Saudi government, they kept their rules. And it's totally separated. So we are a gated community. Once you drive through the gate, everything changed. It's like moving to one of the Southern California cities. And it looks, by the way, like one of the Southern California cities.
Houses with windows that are open,
with
not
high
covered.
Palm trees,
beautiful. Got yards, swimming pools, parks. I mean, all this sounds normal to us, but these are not things that you see out in the world in Saudi Arabia. But still, and so you were able to go and work in an office with other men.
That 38 men, and I was the only woman.
That was crazy and revolutionary. But...
And Dad didn't know I was working with men.
You just kept that from Dad.
Because he would send me back home. Seriously.
But just talk about, like, just to get an apartment, how hard it was to get a place to live.
So there's a chapter, a lot of spoilers today. So there's a chapter in the
book. Oh, yeah, we're spoiling the whole thing, sorry. Well, not the whole thing, but, you know.
There's a chapter I call Employed and Homeless. So finally this woman, she gets a job, and I move to the Eastern Province, which is 2 hours flight from my family house. But the government doesn't allow me to rent a room in the hotel or to rent an apartment. And the company, they have housing for women, but non-Saudi women. So I can be any woman and I can live in the company housing, but if I'm Saudi woman, I cannot. So I felt like, oh my God, they cut my hands, they cut my legs, and they throw me in the sea and they say swim. It was so difficult, but read a book to know how I found an apartment.
Well, explain why it was against the law for you to get even a hotel room.
Oh my God. So to get my hotel room, it has to be under a man name. And they asked me to sneak in and sneak out. Because if they found out there is a girl sleeping in that room alone without a mahram, that would be big trouble.
Things changed.
We have the first woman-only hotel in the world. That's in
Riyadh. Yes. I remember that place.
Only in Saudi Arabia. Things changed.
It was
now women
expensive.
Can recently, the last 2 years, women can rent apartments.
Explain what mahram is.
Mahram is any man I cannot marry. So all the men here are non-mahram to me. But if there is a man who is like my son, my grandfather, my father, my brother, or my my kids, or my, let's say, uncle, they're called mahram. Because
and
I cannot marry them.
They accompany you.
to go if you need to get a hotel or an apartment
yes.
or fly abroad.
Yes.
You the law says you have to have a male guardian
yes.
with you. It's called the guardianship
it's
law.
Very complicated in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Like I can't fly abroad if my father gives me permission without
yes.
him.
Right.
But the guardianship system is simply think of a woman, no matter her age, she's considered minors before the law.
Right.
Minor before the law.
So you could be 50 years old and not get a hotel room
yes.
by yourself, but your 5-year-old son,
he should
he's
be adult.
With you.
Yeah, he should be adult.
He has to be an adult, so he has to be 18 or 16?
Yes.
Or
adult in Saudi Arabia, 18.
Okay.
Yes.
So your 18-year-old son yes. can rent the hotel
yes.
room, but you
My
can't.
My ex-husband, he's the guardian of his mother because
yes.
she's a widow. How insulting to a woman. Mm-hmm. We have July 6th will be the first anniversary of I Am My Own Guardian movement, which is pushing to cancel the guardianship system in Saudi Arabia. And we're hoping, our request is simple. I want the government to name an age for me that I'm considered an adult. I don't need a male guardian.
So you're working at Aramco. You are working with other men. It's, you know, we won't tell everybody how you managed to figure out the living situation. What made you start the Women to Drive campaign?
The movement.
I mean, aside from the Arab Spring, which was happening
yes.
all around, and no one could ignore it. It was
yes.
on every channel and everybody's mind across the region. It was incredible what was happening. But there was some more specific things that happened in your life that made you think
Any
about
driving.
Any 16
years old here in the room? Lady, girls? Anyone who just recently got their driver's license? Oh my God, you're a guy. But let's ask the guy.
How easy for you.
No, what kidding. Did you feel when you got your driver's license? Thank you. What else? You don't need to ask your mom and dad to take you around, right? And your friends,
Free.
And your neighbors, and anyone with a car. Thank you. I made my point. This is my life. So when I got my driver's license, it was the most liberating, and I got it in the U.S. in New Hampshire.
Right.
I had to go to class with young kids like you. I mean, young adults like you, 16 years old. And I was there for 2 months studying. I already knew how to drive. I just didn't have a driver's license, so they didn't allow me to go to the test. At the age of 30, I got my first driver's license. And that was the most emancipating feeling in the world, that I'm an adult. When I went back home to Saudi Arabia, I had a car that I paid this installment for 4 years. And I couldn't drive it. And I have a driver's license. That was really frustrating. I would call every man I know. I would hire drivers to drive my own car. I never had a car accident. All the car accidents happened to my car by drivers. And it's a Cadillac. It's RX. So it's an expensive, beautiful car that at 40s I was paying. That was so frustrating. One time I couldn't even find a car to go back home. And I was in the street walking, looking for a car, calling everyone. And no one would answer. And it was 9 p.m. And I uncovered my face. And that's provocative for the drivers. So I was called all kind of slurs and names and in the street. And one car chased me and almost kidnapped me. That day I was crying in the street, like sobbing like kids. And I was thinking, why I have to go through all this humiliation? The next day I complained to one of my colleagues and he said, but there's no law that bans you from driving. You can go and drive your car. That made me mad. I felt like someone punched me in my stomach that day. And that what led later to the movement of June 17, which is calling women to drive.
Right.
And it was one movement, and there are so many other movements that
yeah.
it's continuing. We will not stop until the first driver license is issued to a Saudi woman.
Yeah. So you started the movement, got a lot of momentum on social media, and then before that you're like, I want to do this video. You make the video. It completely blows up
yes.
online on
yes.
YouTube. Everyone knows.
You remember when I said use the social media that your society is on? So Saudi Arabia is number one worldwide for YouTube video views per capita, more than the U.S. and more than Brazil, which is the two top countries.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Twitter, too. I mean,
the consumption
huge.
Of video. I gave speech last year to YouTube, and they gave me the statistics, the latest statistics. 90 million views per day.
Wow.
The site is 90 million views per day. And that gives you an idea how powerful these tools are. So we used two tools. We used Twitter
just huge saturation.
And Twitter, so many people joined Twitter because of the movement. I remember one guy, he told me he felt ashamed because his mom joined Twitter to follow me. And he had to open his Twitter account. And it became our virtual parliament where people talk and discuss. YouTube, when I posted that video, it was just simple act of showing women it can be done. You can drive a car in the street and you will not be raped and killed as all these stories we hear about. Right. But that went out of proportion. I got 700,000 views that day. And it was trending worldwide, not only in Saudi Arabia. And people were asking, someone in Australia, he's asking, like, why everyone is watching this video? It's just a woman driving.
What's the big deal?
He didn't get it because he was speaking Arabic in the video. Later on, it was translated. But this is it. In Saudi Arabia, it was a big deal.
Yeah, that was a very big deal.
Yes.
And then fast forward to the night the secret police arrived.
Yes, that's chapter one.
And you ended up in jail.
Yes.
For a while.
Yes. So, thankfully, because I talked to the CNN and I talked to Ahmed to tweet, people knew where I was. And that led to an international rally that led to my release. A lot of people talked. Hillary Clinton, by the way, she acknowledged, she called our movement courageous. Six congresswomen, they sent me a letter. Her name is Susan, I think. Catherine Ashton, the high representative of the EU, she also mentioned the movement. We had all this art that happening. We had graffiti in the street with a camel, and it says, I have a camel, I don't have a car. It was beautiful. We had all this, I would say, art, music, movies, movements here in the US and around the world that was inspired by the movement. It's beautiful. You feel like, oh my God, we're not alone.
Again, I won't tell everything because
yes.
We want people to
We'll keep
to
the
read.
Suspense.
Yeah. I mean, the time in jail was very harrowing. Yes. It was not.
It was.
Nice.
It took me a year. I couldn't talk about the time I was in jail because I was strip searched when I entered. And I'm not a criminal. Right. I just drove a car. I think that was the most difficult thing for me when I entered jail.
And I think the other thing that it's important for people to understand is Saudi Arabia isn't a place with like a really set, knowable law, you know, there wasn't this, you know, you didn't go before a judge, you didn't,
no,
even just getting a lawyer to come visit you was
no.
really hard. And in the end, what got you released
was my dad going to meet the king.
Yeah, your dad, because you can still do this in Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm.
you can go personally petition
mm-hmm.
the king.
Yes, because we live in a tribal society and it's patriarchal society.
Right. So your dad and the leader of his tribe and a couple of people went to the palace, again, read about it in the book, it's unbelievable. And said, you know, you gotta let this go, and he did. And so, you know, it's funny because there was a similar case in Saudi Arabia a few years before. There was a girl who was found in a car with another boy, and then it's a horrific crime. The two of them were then kidnapped and taken out into the woods and sexually assaulted. She was sentenced to 200 lashes for being in the car with the boy, even though she was the victim of...
She was a group...
It was a group assault. And that case ended with the king issuing a pardon, you know? And so it was this sense that, like, there isn't really a rule of law, but if this one guy is nice enough, you know, we could get him to end this injustice. And in some ways, it's great that neither of you were punished, and that's the way the story ended. But it's also so arbitrary. I mean, do you think about that?
Yes, it is unpredictable. Like yesterday, I couldn't sleep. I was in Dallas, speaking in Dallas, and I have a 6 a.m. flight, but I couldn't sleep. The whole night, I was following, they removed the crown prince, and they put a new crown prince.
Yeah.
And I was like, and he's younger than me. We are 60% under the age of 25, but we always have kings that are 3 times our age.
Right.
So there is this huge gap between us and them. And finally, someone who understands Twitter and Snapchat, he's going to be our king.
Right.
There was these things are unpredictable. You just wake up one day and you don't understand what's going on in my country.
Right.
And that's, I hope, with the new leadership of the government or the country, we would not have these, I would say, surprises. We would be at least consulted and informed.
Huh.
I hope there will be political power change. I mean, the political system change that involves people. I hope. This is my hope as a Saudi citizen.
Yeah. that king who did pardon you,
he passed away.
He's no longer the king. So, I mean, you have to wonder. Do you wonder sometimes, like, what if it had been another one? What would have happened?
I never thought of that.
Yeah.
Yes. It just what happened, really. Yeah. It's, you never know what. I didn't know I was going to end in jail. I didn't know that it will be international movement.
Uh-huh.
Really.
And it's, I'm sure you must think that it was that some. It had to do, because it was the same with the Katif case.
Yes.
It had to be that international pressure that helped.
Did you hear about Shema Justinian?
His decision, you know, that so, he cared about.
Yes. So, yearly, the same year, we had this huge fight. 40 years, the king, he issued an order that allowing women to work in the public space. Mm-hmm. I used to buy my underwear from a man. You bought your underwear from a man in Saudi?
Of course.
Yes.
So
imagine you go to the mall and the man sells women's underwear.
It was such a big debate.
Amazing, right? The contradictions. And the king, he issued an order, and the order wasn't effective for 4 years. So he had to come again and issue an order, a decree, a royal decree from the king, his majesty the king, to say a woman should sell a woman underwear. This is how complicated
that we need. This is what gets adjudicated, yeah.
And it's too, it's suffocating, really, to me,
yeah.
That you have to always go that extent
right.
to issue rules like this, I mean, laws like this. So Shema Justinia, she drove that year in 2011. She was sentenced to 10 lashes. It was overturned by the king himself.
Right.
So it's...
But it also, like, it so serves the king too, right? To say, look, I'm this benevolent leader. I've
has 18 million, and now, oh my God, 18 million people. I have to decide who sells lingerie or underwear.
Right. But if I take away, if I also issue the pardon, and then everyone will think I'm, this great guy. It is interesting.
But hopefully it changed.
Right.
It doesn't have to go all the way to king himself.
I wonder,
has more important things than my lingerie, really.
Sure. So you have hope in this younger crown
big
prince.
Big time. Yes.
Yeah. That things might not be so arbitrary.
He's very ambitious and very smart. I know he will make mistakes, but it's part of the process. But he has honest and sincere will to lead the country, to be away from addiction to oil, and to empower women. His vision, the 2030, that he wants 30%, hopefully even more, of women to be part of the workforce. Our workforce is 90% non-Saudis. So out of 10 private sector employees, 9 non-Saudis.
And non-Saudis.
Yeah,
right.
And that's because the Saudis prefer the public sector because it's more secure, job secure, better salaries, and better benefits. No one prefers the private sector. And they change the job. So even the owner, he doesn't prefer to have a Saudi. Women accept anything. I find my friends who are cashiers, she's a college graduate. They accept everything
right.
because there are no jobs for them.
Right.
So it's all this lost potential of women. Hopefully things change with the new change in power.
Yeah. You don't live in Saudi Arabia anymore.
I go back. I'm flying back to Saudi. I had to change my flight to stay 2 days here.
Stay in L.A. But you don't live there anymore. You left after all of this. Oop. You got it okay? Oops. Take a minute.
I couldn't turn it off.
I'll turn it off like that. Give us a second. Sorry, no.
We can talk about your experience.
No. No, I'm not interested. But I mean, after all of this, after getting out of jail and after the pardon and, some other stuff, you did leave. And do you think you'll ever live there again? You visit. You think you'll ever live there again? Yep. And you can think about it for a long time.
That's the end of my tour today. So you can imagine.
You can guess the answer.
Can I turn this off? Can I turn it off?
Yeah, they can turn it off up there. You guys can turn it off, right?
I don't want to cough in your face.
Sorry. We'll just have a couple more questions and then we'll do. Just a couple more questions for you. And then we'll take questions from the audience. Okay. You got it? Is it ready? Are we ready? Yeah. Do you think you'll ever live there again? You do? You think you'll ever live in Saudi again?
Yes. Oh, my God. I'm flying back. And the problem is my second marriage is not recognized by the government. So if you're Saudi, wants to marry an Ansari, whether you are a man or a woman, you need a special permission from the Minister of Interior. He's changed.
Uh-huh.
So I'll go to the new Minister of Interior. I went to the first. He died. I went to his son. He refused.
Right.
Now, the third one, I'm going to go again. I will never give up because I want my marriage to be recognized in my country because I have a second son from my second husband who never met his brother.
So that's what's keeping you from living there, is that?
Yes, I cannot. Thank you. I cannot. Thanks. I cannot go and leave Daniel
right
with his father. I have to take him with me, and I can't take him with me. He's not recognized as Saudi or as my son.
And what is... How would you characterize the status of the movement? I know, again, people get discredited. The movement can fracture,
yes.
You know. I think you were saying backstage and that all your hope is in the millennials.
In the millennia.
Yeah. What are they doing? Like, what?
I think the millennia are changing the world as we know it, whether in the U.S., in Europe, anywhere. They're changing the rules, how corporates work, how jobs are, how everything is functioning. They're going to even change the political systems in countries. And they are the agent of change in Saudi Arabia. As I told you, we're a very young generation.
Yeah.
I mean, we're a very young nation.
Yeah.
We're one of the youngest nations in the world. And they are changing everything. They're fearless, courageous, and I'm inspired by the millennia. And I know they will change. They will push for change.
With you as an inspiration.
I hope.
Manal Sharif, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you so much. Thank you.
We are ready to take questions. The microphones are available, and they're coming to you.
Well, I moved to Jeddah in 1986, and they were telling me, oh, any day now, women are going to drive. What's your best prediction?
Oh, boy.
What do you think? Women will drive when they want.
I'll say 5 years.
I would say when they want.
When do you think, you know, that first driver's license will be issued?
So I'm starting a social enterprise in Sydney because they moved to Sydney. It's called Drive for Freedom. And I'm paying for women, even the money that I get from this book, I'm paying for women, Saudi woman living abroad. When she gets her driver license, I'll ask her to send me the receipts and a picture of her driver license. I'm going to embrace her, reimburse her. Yes, those are my agents who change. I'm recruiting. So when they go back, they drive. Women will drive when they want. The problem is they don't realize their power because the government cannot stop 9 million women driving. They can stop 1 or 2 or 10, but not the whole society.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I wanted to find out, what do you think that the young men are thinking? What, for instance, what do you hear from them, the men, in the young boys in Saudi Arabia who are 16, 17? What's the word on the street? How are they thinking and how are they changing or how are they not changing based on the older generation? What do you think? What's going on with the young men?
I have a boy who's 12. He's so proud of me. And I know boys in Saudi Arabia his age and older than him, the teenagers, he calls himself tween. I learned this word from him. But the teens in Saudi Arabia, as I mentioned, they're very smart. I get inspired by the extent of things they go. My generation, we're always being shut down. We're always being told, just listen to the rules. They create their rules. They don't follow rules. They create their own rules. And you find more and more of the penetration of internet in Saudi Arabia is 90%, 90, mostly through the phones. So most of them are the young generation using the internet, creating even platforms to talk, creating platforms to... We really are not that advanced when it comes to having social events and civil society. Civil society is banned by law in Saudi Arabia. But they create their own civil society online. It's amazing.
How long were you jailed?
Yes.
And if your father hadn't intervened with the king,
yes,
how long would you have languished in jail?
I have no clue. I don't have an answer to that. But I would say for a long, long time. I know a lot of girls. Lujain al-Hadlul, she drove in 2014, I think. She tried to cross the borders from Emirates to Saudi Arabia. She was in jail for 72 days for that attempt. And she didn't even drive on the Saudi line. She just attempted to drive. So it gets really nasty. But it's, you know, it's not bad because we've been always told that we're bluffing. But now they're taking us seriously. Otherwise, they wouldn't put us in jail. Yes.
Thank you for speaking. It's terrific to hear your story. I'm curious to know, were you brought up in a very liberal environment? Were your parents, can you talk a little bit about that? And if you weren't, it sounds like you just shook your head, you weren't. What was their reaction to your activism? Especially your dad's.
Especially mine?
Your dad.
My father.
Yes.
I love my father. It's really complicated. When you read the book, you understand how we all changed. Me, my father, my brother. But the society plays a big part of pressure putting in. Even the things you don't want to do, you don't believe in, you have to adhere to because it's not your say. You receive so much pressure from the society to follow the rules. I was radical Muslim. My family were observant, I would say. But later on, mom, in the last 10 years, she became radical Muslim. And that was really shocking. So it's I would say stages that goes in our life.
But they definitely weren't liberal Saudis. I mean, they were not. I mean, there are liberal Saudis in Riyadh.
There are liberal
Saudis. People get together
Saudis.
And talk about politics, and
you know,
but
they
were not.
But how do you find liberal?
Right.
Even
the most liberal Saudis,
when it comes to the rules of the society,
yeah.
They strictly follow.
They still
it.
Wouldn't want
their daughter to marry non-Saudi,
right, or out without.
My dad had friends from Egypt and from Sudan. But when my sister wanted to marry someone who's Arab, non-Saudi, dad said no. And I'm like, wow. That's when I understood how complicated is my society. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
First of all, thank you so much for your inspiration and your courageousness.
Thank you.
You're truly an inspiration.
Thank you.
I wanted to find out what your life is like when you go back to Saudi Arabia, how you deal with Matawa and at how you live there
today
with people knowing who you are and what you've done.
It's not easy. I get harassed, but I think the only way is to be there and try to change the system from within. Any person who challenges the status quo will be challenged anywhere. And there is a special punishment hold for the woman who speaks up. Again, anywhere. If a man gives his opinion, he's a man. If a woman gives her opinion, she's a bitch. I'm sorry to say this. This is what, as a strong woman, usually this is what the society perceives strong woman. So in my society, it's the same, because as a woman, I'm expected to be obedient, not speak up. And it does create so much conflict with the men, that you as a woman speaking up. But something is changing. Even men today saying, learn from the Saudi woman how to fight for your rights, because we're not giving up. It's not easy, but I have hope, I would say. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yes, my question is a little more general. What do you think the relationship between the new crown prince and the Wahhabis is going to be? Because the Wahhabis...
The crown prince, he stripped the religious police, the deputy crown prince, he's now the crown prince, he stripped the religious police from the power of arrest. Imagine you're driving your car. You know what are the driving, the violations that you could commit, right? Like running through a red light or not stopping at the stop sign. The religious police don't have that code. So it's very subjective. You could be just walking in the street and get arrested for reasons you don't understand. That was very terrifying. This changed because of the crown prince. And I think the crown prince, the government gave them so much, I would say, not excuses, they gave them so much power to control the society and control women in specific. To impose all these rules on us as women. I don't think they can tolerate that anymore. There is a limit, really, to accept where the government has to stand and say, enough is enough. And this is what I'm hoping will happen in these coming years.
Did you say that you live in Sydney?
Yes.
So I presume you also spend a lot of time here. So my question is this. Control of women, patriarchy, male domination is very, very obvious and specific in Saudi Arabia. But I still think it exists in Sydney and Los Angeles and across the liberal countries, but it's infinitely more subtle. Can you tell me ways in which you see it subtly? And do you have any feelings about things that should change here because they're anti-feminist?
In the U.S.?
Yes.
What's the word subtling? What does it mean?
Subtling? Subtle. Oh, you sort of, yeah, more sort of quiet.
Oh, unclear.
Yeah. It's like, oh, not overt, you know, overt sort of you can't drive, but it's more like.
It's soft. They call it the soft oppression.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes.
Sure.
Did you watch Misrepresentation?
I haven't, but I haven't seen it.
That's a great movie to watch. I mean, great documentary to watch. So when I lived here in 2009, I was staggered by the fact that my girlfriend, she was in deep debt paying her college loan. And she was paying, it was the 2009, so it was the year of depression. She was paying 37% interest rate on her college loan. And I was like, so when are you going to finish it? She said, I don't think so, I'm going to finish it in any sooner. So she would work as a waitress. She's a tax consultant. She graduated from Brown University. She's a very intelligent girl. And she was working as a waitress. That shocked me. American girl who's highly educated, who has access to jobs, she had to do that.
But a male would have to do that as well.
Exactly, both. But for me, that was the first thing that shocked me, because she was a girl. The second thing that shocked me, my other girlfriend, she had to take the maternity leave, a sick leave, because her employer wouldn't pay her. And I said, wow, we take up to 4 years in Saudi Arabia, wow, maternity leave, with fourth hour of salary, if you work for the government. And that really shocked me, to know these things, the difference. So there are always, it's very important when I read a book like this, my memoir, someone from Saudi Arabia, we have misconception about Americans as much as Americans have misconceptions about us. But it's very important that we reflect. I was in this conference and the lady, she said, after I told my story, and there was a Pakistani lady told her story and someone from Africa, she stood and she told the American woman, we were in Beverly Hills here, and she said, I brought this woman to tell you how lucky we are to grow up Americans. I was surprised. Why would she bring me here to tell the woman, you should feel lucky because these women are oppressed? Instead of saying, how about we open, we look back, we reflect, we see what are the things we need to change here. Thank you. So I think it's really, really important when I read someone else's story, every American I meet, I ask the same question. Did you reflect? Did you relate to? Did you see yourself there? That's the only person who will say yes is the person who has an open mind when he reads other people's story or he looks at the other people. And I hope women here, they find something to say, I can learn to speak up, I can learn to stand for myself, and I can learn to be there and not let the society control how I look like or the standard that I have to follow to be beautiful. Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your inspiring story. I'm
Thank
wondering
you.
What we as Westerners can do to be supportive of you. Is there any potentially bill in Congress that we can beg this hopeless Congress to support, perhaps? Following you on Twitter comes to mind, but anything beyond that that we could do that would contribute and empower your movement?
I think exercise your rights. Don't take it as a privilege. Take it as an obligation. And use your liberty to defend other people's liberty. Saudi Arabia and the U.S. are very close allies. It goes back to President Roosevelt. And I'm so surprised, administration after administration, there's never been that true push or pressure on Saudi Arabia, political pressure or diplomatic pressure, to promote more women's rights and political rights and human rights in my country. So I think that's your...
I think we're going to do one more. Yeah,
yes.
That's a good answer.
As a democracy.
Got one more? Oh,
hi.
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to hear you
speak. Thank you.
You made the analogy driving while black, and it just, and some things kind of struck me about how we were talking about how arbitrary the prince decisions are. And I often feel like that, especially with a lot of decisions with respect to shootings of men and women of color recently, and how arbitrary decisions are, legal decisions. And I was wondering how, if you can kind of relate to that, or, you know, what your thoughts are with kind of the, hopefully the revolution that's happening in the United States. I feel like it's so slow, and even though we're pushing on social media, nothing's changing.
Nothing changing here or in Saudi Arabia?
Here with shootings with...
Yes, in the U.S.
Specifically,
the Black Lives Matter?
Yes,
I've been following that. Do you believe that the most inspiring story to me in my activism was Rosa Parks? She didn't give up her seat. And they said she was tired. She said, I was tired of giving. I wasn't tired. I was tired of giving in. And when I was following the civil rights movement in the U.S., it was staggering, all the similarities. It gets under my skin. It's exactly, remove a black person, just put aside a woman. This is my country. I'm not allowed in public libraries. I'm not allowed to do anything without the permission from my sponsor, which is my guardian. I'm not allowed to mix with men because I'm sin, because I'm seductive. It's exactly with the black people here in the southern states where I was reading about the civil rights movement. I learned a lot from watching movies like The Butler and 12 Years Slave, and the last one, the Hidden Figures. And I think you've been doing something great, but emphasize education. There are more black men in jail than in colleges. Emphasize education. Education is what got me out of poverty and what got me out to what I believe that is liberating to my, I would say, the womanhood in Saudi Arabia is education. I think emphasizing that. I know with poverty it's very difficult to get, we didn't get good education, but the family has big part in emphasizing an education, bringing books. Dad would take me to a library. He would check out the books for me because I was not allowed to go to the library. That's very important. That not only depending on the public schools and the public education, which is usually is not the best, but also emphasizing that the families invest so much in their kids' education. Nothing liberates people more than education. And by the way, black people were banned from going to public libraries. They were banned from even good education. When I was watching The Hidden Figure, she was not even allowed to go to the college. I'm banned from going to engineering schools in my country. I didn't want to go to computer science, but women were not allowed to study engineering in my country. Until today, by the way, only private schools teach engineering. Or you have to fly to go abroad. When you read the chapter about Aramco, you will see a lot of similarities. How I was treated just because I was a woman. Education. That's my answer.
And one more time, Marla.
Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.